Good morning, everyone, online and in person. It's our great pleasure to welcome to Westminster someone who hasn't been here before, Dr. Tanner Capps, who is director of the Miller Youth Institute at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. And the funny thing about Tanner that I had no idea about is that we grew up about, a little over 30 miles from each other in upstate South Carolina. And so it's been kind of fun to catch up on things. Of course, I'm a whole lot older than he is, but we have some things in common. So I'll let him tell you a little bit more about himself, and he's going to talk about Christ and humanity's cosmic future. And I know we're all very curious. So thank you.
Is this on? Can you hear me? Okay. Well, thank you. I am very new to Pittsburgh. We've been here about a year, and some change. We moved, my wife and I, with our three children, moved from Laurinburg, North Carolina, where I was teaching at St. Andrew's Presbyterian College, small liberal arts college down there. And before or after that, I taught for a year at UNC Wilmington and the Honors College. Is there a question? My background's in theology and early modern studies, some work on art, theology and the arts that I did at Duke University. And like I said, I taught at a small PCUSA school for a while, ran the honors program there. I was sending students to the Miller Youth Institute here at PTS from about 2016. From St. Andrews, and I brought a group of students up here to visit the seminary. So I got to know and I had a really good friend from graduate school who was teaching church history at the seminary. And so that's how I got connected when I was looking to serve the denomination more deliberately. This position came open while I was at UNCW. And so I applied, and here I am. I want to say a quick word about the programming that we run. I ran my first in-person institute. We called it a fellowship program for undergraduates ages 19 to 22. And it was actually on this theme. And I'm going to say a little bit about how we arrived at this theme of eco-theology and ecology programming for young people. But if you know any undergraduates in the area, we had no local students in the institute that I ran. This past summer, they were from all over the country, but not from Pittsburgh. So if y'all know of any young people who would be good candidates for the programming we run, it's a six-week program. A stipend is paid. There's living accommodations. Everything's taken care of. And we run on Monday and Tuesdays, we run workshops related to some theme in the study of ecology and theology. And then on Wednesdays, we do an outing somewhere. We did things like Lake Arthur and went over to Ohio Pile to do some canoeing and kayaking, lots of stuff in the city. And then Thursdays, we work with our community partner, who I have heard is a friend of this church, or at least the church has been a friend to this community partner, Garfield Community Farm, in the Garfield neighborhood of Pittsburgh. We ran every Thursday permaculture practices with Reverend John Creasy, who worked with our students, and we were taking permaculture and merging that with the study of theology and scripture for our students. And then because I didn't want to over-program the summer for them, they had Friday, Saturday, and Sunday off. Our worship experience was at East Liberty Presbyterian Church, their Taizé service, and then we had a community cookout on Wednesday afternoons too. So we're going to run the same thing. We bring in people from all over the country to work with the young adults. And if you know of anyone, please, please look me up and send them my way. I would love to have them be part of the program. So that's what I'm doing at PTS. I've got other programs that I'm working on, one at Presbyterian College, one up at Westminster College, some stuff in the city for alternative spring break with Muskingum University over in Ohio. So we've got a lot going on, but we're also emerging from COVID still. It feels like there was not much going with the Miller Youth Institute because of COVID. They did some virtual programming. So I've really got my work cut out for me, reconvening people in person. And find me later and we'll talk about it. Well, let's get into it then. So Christ and humanity's cosmic future, what are we talking about? My interest in this, I'll give you a little bit of background on the project. So I have a kind of longstanding environmental interest, partly because of where I grew up. When I was in high school, this would have been 96 or so, 98, somewhere between 96 and 98. I didn't look up the precise date. A family was on the Chattooga River. I think they were from Ohio, if I remember correctly. And the Chattooga River is a wild and scenic river in upstate South Carolina, designated in the 1970s. That means that, among other things, that building can't take place within a certain amount of miles of the river. It's a protected watershed. Certain kind of boats can't be up in the river, et cetera, et cetera. I won't go into it. But the wild and scenic designation had been in place since around 1976 for Chattooga. That was about 15 minutes from where I grew up. I grew up on that river. Gorgeous. You will recognize it because it's from, I hate to mention it, but it's where Deliverance was filmed in the 1970s. That's the Chattooga River. And they used folks from North Georgia and upstate South Carolina as some of the backing actors. Well, anyway, when I was in high school in the 90s, I think I was around 15 years old, this family from Ohio was there vacationing or whatever on the river. And a girl, I believe she was about middle school age, slipped in on what was called the Raven's Rock Rapid, gorgeous spot on the river, like huge granite rock face and then a rapid down below. But she fell in the river and drowned. And so this is Strom Thurmond was a senator at the time, and this whole debate began to emerge around, could they build a temporary dam upriver to recover her body? And a book has been written about it by an author named Ron Rash. I believe the book's called Saints at the River. And it was this massive debate that took place in this tiny rural county around environmentalism and what could be done to the river to recover a human body. And being a young person at the time, I mean, this is a real moral struggle, and we're going to get into some of this later this morning. Is it okay to not destroy or disrupt a habitat to recover a human body that's already deceased? What ended up happening, there were town halls that were held on it in a place called Temecula, South Carolina. I went to one of them to listen in. This is sort of my budding environmentalism was starting. I was listening to all the debate, you know, so yeah, the people, no, we've got to get that little girl's body out, right? That's a fair position, right? The family needed some kind of closure to the event. And then another side, no, this is a wild and scenic. They should have known better than to get that close to the rapid. And this is what happens to people when they don't respect the river. That was the other. And so she would wash out when she washed out, and that would be the end of it. What ended up happening was they didn't build the temporary dam, and she finally, I assume, decomposed in some way, and her body washed out of the rapid. So here I am thinking about, what is humanity's place in the world, right? Who are we alongside other creatures? I'll fast forward to part of what I realized why I came to Pittsburgh. When I was teaching in southeastern North Carolina, two major hurricanes hit the coast of North Carolina in less than 3 years. I grew up inland, as Sarah said, in upstate South Carolina. We did not experience hurricanes. We might get some of the aftermath, right, like of Hugo or something when it blew through Charleston. Blew through is way too euphemistic of it, when it leveled parts of Charleston. When I was teaching at UNCW and at St. Andrews, we were displaced for like 3 or 4 weeks. We had to leave. We evacuated. We had no idea what was going to happen. The campus of St. Andrews had 5.5 feet of water in its dining hall. Almost, you know, you could go see the water line. They are still not back in their dining hall. this hurricane happened in 2019 and they happened back to back. I didn't realize until I was working with my students this summer, we read a book on climate migration and climate displacement to kind of talk about Christian hospitality and what's happening with mass migration due to climate change, climate crisis, as it were. And in those discussions with my students, I realized part of the conversation that my wife and I had when we were trying to decide whether to take the job at PTS was that we just did not want to deal with more hurricanes in southeastern North Carolina. The water in Laurinburg stuck around for like a year and a half in some of the farmers' fields because the edges of the gutters, as it were, of the fields had not been cleared properly. People were gone. Some people have not come back. Places like Wagram, North Carolina, and Laurinburg, they left and no one knows where they went. I say all that to say that I didn't realize it until I was in conversation with my students that in some way we moved to Pittsburgh because we realized it was going to be a climate resilient city, given its access to fresh water, its elevation, and its location in the country. I had a student from Southern California. She had experienced the campfire, if you remember some of that news reporting. She came to my program this summer. She said, we could see the mountain burning outside my house in Azusa, California. Another student from Minneapolis had experienced this in West Africa. I was like, oh my gosh, like a quarter of the people in this program this summer have been directly impacted somehow by human caused climate change. So these two things were coming together for me. I had this sort of background formative experience when I was a kid, and then this more, I don't know, existential threat feeling when I was an adult teaching due to the hurricanes coming through southeastern North Carolina. And so I began to ask myself, what in the world does what I do, which is study theology and write and think, what does this have to do with my life in terms of my environmental interest and my ecological concerns? Okay, you can go to the next slide. A project I've been working on recently is with the Journal of Reformed Theology, and we're going to get to this guy's work. You may have heard of Doug Ottotti. He's a Presbyterian theologian, been around. He teaches down at Davidson. I was asked to write on a book that he recently published called A Theology for the 21st Century. And one of the things that Doug does in that book is he really front loads environmental concern and catastrophe as an existential threat to humanity, as sort of the concern of our age. Like if we can't deal with what's going on there, there's really not much of a conversation to be had because it's such a profound threat, not one that I don't think we're going to necessarily see in our lifetime, right? But in terms of grandchildren or great-grandchildren, this is going to be a massive problem. So the article that I wrote for the JRT, the Journal of Reformed Theology, was called Extinction, Annihilation, and Cosmic Passage. Pretty grim stuff, right? But really, it was an essay on hope, right? What does our Christian life together, what does Christ have to teach us about hoping in a time of crisis? Because this is not the last time, or the first time or the last time that we're going to have to think about this as Christians. So I noticed also that the JRT had hosted a symposium on ecology, theology, and climate change. So this was beginning to kind of get into the mainstream. People were starting to talk about it in a way that I hadn't seen before. I'm afraid oftentimes that we've held our relationship to the environment, let's just call it the world, right, over here in our Christian faith, our life of worship over here. But I think there's some promising moves. This is part of it, right? We're sitting here talking about it, that are moving us forward to begin to integrate this conversation. As I said, I developed a 6-week program for young people that was on this topic. So I'm trying to address it in numerous ways. And one thing that I really want us thinking about over this week and next week is how do we move from just thinking about it and being concerned about it to actual practices of hope together? That's to move to action, right? Because if we're not moving to action, I really don't see the point in sitting around and fretting about it. So what we were working on with our students were just some basic practices of care for oneself and care for one's community that were informed by these conversations about the environment. So what I want to do, that showed up a lot better on my screen when I was making this slide. You can like barely read it, geez. Okay, let me read to you what's up on the screen. So what I want to do is sketch out a theological framework for how I've started thinking about this question. So what's up on the screen that you can't read too well because I didn't do a great job with color theory and it's just all blended together, is that I want to make 5 theological claims and then raise 3 questions. And the 3 questions are really going to point us to our work together next week. So here's some simple claims that I hope we can all agree on as Christians. Okay, 1, God is gracious creator and sustainer, is sovereign over all life. And there's nothing more sovereign than God over all life. So this means at least 2 things. 1, God did not have to create the world, and God created and creates out of an abundance of grace. We're all here out of abundance of God's grace. So the world that we are gifted with is a gift out of God's gracious gratuity. 2, God did not create and then abandon God's creation. Rather, God is actively and intimately involved in the continuation, and we may even say the evolution, whatever that means, right? The continuation of species, of life on earth. I'll say that 1 more time. God did not create, then abandon creation. Rather, God is actively and intimately involved with it, right? So when I experience 2 major hurricanes that displace me and my family for a few weeks, disrupt the flow of my work, teaching, all of this, I have to ask the question, how is God? Where is God in this, right? The old Job question, is God in the whirlwind, as it were? 2nd point. It is through our relationship with all other life that God creates and sustains us. So God's creative work and God's sustaining work happens through our relationship with other creatures. So what does this mean? 1, humanity does not stand apart from all other life, but is intimately enmeshed with it, whether we recognize it or not, right? Our gut biomes, right? The mites or whatever that might get in our hair, the tick that bites my son and gives him Lyme disease a few weeks ago, we're enmeshed with other life. 2, this is also a call to participate and care for life. And we're going to talk about this a little bit when we look at Genesis chapter 2. All right, so 2 things: humanity does not stand apart from all other life, but is intimately enmeshed in it. And 2, we're called to participate, right? This is a call. This is a good reformed category, participation in the world. 3, therefore, human life is interconnected with and dependent on all other life on earth. We are dependent creatures. And this just means really 1 thing I would like to clarify. We tend to acknowledge our interconnectedness, at least intellectually. I think we're all aware, kind of intellectually, right, that we're dependent on other creatures, other forms of life. But often we fail to act and develop policies as if we were dependent creatures. So this is what the debate that I got to witness in Temecula, South Carolina, was: what kind of dependent creatures are we, right? With the young woman's body in the rapid of the Chattooga River, right? Is humanity above and over and all things serve us, right? Or are we somehow a part of it? Right, that was part of the debate that was going on. 4, the human species, like all other species, has a beginning and will come to an end. This is a point I get from Doug Ottotti's work, and you're going to see this reflected on the very last slide from the presentation. But the human species has a beginning. So we as a species, not us as individuals, our species has a beginning cosmically, and it will come to an end. Now, this just raises questions for me theologically, okay? Number one, what are we to do with this reality that our species will one day cease to exist? I think we risk becoming complacent or apathetic or just falling into despair when we consider this question, or at least I do. So the question becomes, how are we to relate to God and other species in our allotment of cosmic time and cosmic space? I think this is the fundamental theological question. How do we relate to God, right, vertically, and then to other creatures horizontally, that our species will one day cease to exist? A fifth claim, and finally, I'm convinced that it's through the incarnation of Jesus Christ we come to understand how we ought to relate to God and how we ought to relate to all that is not God. Christ teaches us something about our relationship to God and then our relationship to not just one another, but all other creatures. And that's what we're going to work on next week, is what is it that the incarnation of Jesus Christ as a human teaches us about the vertical and the horizontal relationships. And here, just to be clear, we're talking about the eternal Word, the logic of God, the reason of God being made flesh. Why did God incarnate as a human and not something else? A bat or a rat or whatever, right? What is it about humanity that is particular to God's wanting to be for and with the world? Now I want to point out that this language of the ought is the question of social ethics. The ought here, when we begin to reflect on the incarnation of Jesus, is about relationship and responsibility. So next week, I want to begin to reflect a little bit on what kind of relationship Jesus began to cultivate in our hearts, right? Our disposition towards others. What kinds of responsibilities do we learn about to others through the incarnation and the ministry of Jesus? So along those lines, I've just got three questions I want to raise. Then this is going to be kind of obvious. What does the humanity of Jesus teach us about our relationship with all other life? Right? What is it about the particular humanity of Jesus that forces us to consider other life on earth? How should we understand Christ's humanity in light of the pending cessation of our species? That's the question I talk about. It's one that's just sort of open-ended for me. And then finally, what does the ministry of Jesus teach us about being full participants in God's world, right? Because this is about participation, being with, for, and alongside others. We'll stop right there. Y'all have any questions that I need to clarify here? Should we just move on? All right, next slide. No, y'all are gonna answer for me. No, I don't think that. Well, I think we will, or I'm gonna at least like sketch out some partial answers. Yeah. Other question?
I'm curious about the cessation of our species.
Yes.
That's not something I've ever thought about.
I know. Oh, I hadn't either until I read this Doug Ottotti, his work. I think this, oh my word, these look so good when I made them the other day. I think this might begin to get at the challenge. I don't, on the cessation of the species, I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, but people are clearly concerned about it, right? Like there's all of this discussion about like colonizing Mars, right? Getting away from Earth because we've screwed it up so bad, right? That we might not be able to survive here. You know, this is like the Elon Musk futurism stuff that's being, it's still pretty out there right now, but I mean, we're beginning to get pretty real about the, yeah. Ted.
So, you know, even at a lower level, I think people have a tough time these days embracing the idea of their own mortality, let alone the mortality of humans. We kind of rely on technology, like going to Mars, or medical technology to give us some sort of reassurance that our life is not going to end, when surely it is.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think this is some of the moral bio, like bioethics stuff that we're talking about here, right? What's the guy out in like California, right? He was like taking blood from his 16-year-old son and storing it so it could be put back into his body. because he wants to live for, I don't know why one would want to do that, but.
And I see that here when we talk about death and dying, people just glaze over like, boring. That's not relevant to me.
Right.
Well, as we learn more and more about Mars, it's mm-hmm. very clear that at one time it was a very different place.
Yes.
That was welcoming to life.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's all kinds of things on TV that explain mm-hmm. what happened. And many, you can see the beginnings of those in all that you're describing.
Right.
So to me, this is not hyperbole at all.
Sure. Well, thank you. Yeah. I mean, I think with the students this summer, they're like, yeah, like this is a threat, right? But when I've presented this in some other places, they're like, yeah, not a big deal, right? But what's the big concern? Right. Yeah, no, thank you for that. Well, let me read this real quick about the ecological challenge before us. And I'm just going to proceed as if this is the case. I realize this is a sort of a debate, right, in some circles, but I want to just kind of assume that this is what's going on and then do some theology out of it. So this is a work that I cite in my review of Doug Ottotti's book. So here's what the scientists say from an article called The Sixth Mass Extinction, Fact, Fiction, or Speculation. So there have been at least 5 mass extinction events in the history of Earth's biodiversity. Here's the particular thing, all caused by dramatic but natural phenomena. And what the authors mean here is not caused by a species manipulating, right, the Earth. It has been claimed that the sixth mass extinction may be underway, this time caused entirely by humans, although there's considerable evidence that indicates that there is biodiversity crisis of increasing extinctions and plummeting abundances. While this is the case, some do not accept that this amounts to a sixth mass extinction. Humans are the only species able to manipulate the Earth on a grand scale, and we have allowed the current crisis to happen. Despite multiple conservation initiatives at various levels, most are not species-oriented, although there are certain charismatic vertebrates accepted. So, you know, whatever, like the panda or something, it's cute. Therefore, we want to take care of its ecological home. In specific actions to protect every living species individually, this is interesting, are not simply feasible because of the tyranny of the numbers. And what they mean here is that the biodiversity loss is so grand, right, that trying to preserve the species as we know it is just not possible. So here's what they say. We reaffirm the message that the biodiversity that makes our world so fascinating, beautiful, and functional is vanishing unnoticed at an unprecedented rate. In the face of a mounting crisis, scientists must adopt the practices of reviving the venerable study of natural history and taxonomy. Denying the crisis, simply accepting it and doing nothing, or even embracing it for the ostensible benefit of humanity, are not appropriate options and pave the way for the Earth to continue on its sad trajectory towards a sixth mass extinction. So what's interesting to me about what these biologists are writing is that they're using words like beauty. They're using words like the Earth is inherently fascinating. They're using words like it's sad. Those don't sound very sciencey to me. Those sound emotional, right? They sound like aesthetics, that there's something beautiful about the diversity of life on Earth. They don't sound very mechanistic, right? I don't associate that kind of thinking with science. So I think this is a generous invitation to have theologians weigh in, right? Why ought we to preserve what we have, right? What kinds of moral commands does our God give us about taking care of life on Earth? So you can go to the next slide. So let's talk about anthropocentrism. Then what these scientists are really after is talking about human-centered thinking, right? The way that we see ourselves or our species as the be-all, end-all of creation, right? That this has generated some major problems in our world. So here's a good, simple definition of what is anthropocentrism. Anthropocentrism is a view of the world that evaluates the universe by human standards and values. Now, I really like this definition because it gives us a little bit of slack, right? It's not just, you know, like making us feel bad about ourselves. Anthropocentrism is not in itself a complete belief system, but rather a view that can be seen interwoven throughout many different cultures. So, in other words, it's not just a Western problem, right? All human cultures have this issue of seeing humans perhaps as the center of the universe. To a certain extent, all human thinking is naturally anthropocentric. And this should not come as a surprise, right? The way that we engage the world is from a human perspective. That's kind of obvious, right? Human values and experiences are the only basis humanity has by which to measure and to understand the universe around them. And it's very difficult, if not impossible, to separate oneself and one's experiences and values from how we process the world. So anthropocentrism, what this means really from a philosophical or theological vantage point is that all things serve us, right? That creation exists for the benefit of humans. But what I like about this definition is it says, well, yeah, that is anthropocentrism, right? But how else can we process the world? Now, we do know, right? My students and I talked about this summer, that there are other cultures, some cultures, right, that definitely saw humanity as deeply interwoven and responsible to the patterns of other life, right, and other forms of existence in their immediate neighborhood, right? Indigenous practices around farming, right, that were not monocropping. You think of the three sisters of Native American planting, right, corn, bean, and the pumpkin. These were not monocropped. The corn, right, served as the stalk by which the bean grew up, right? And then there was an understanding that these three things needed one another, and so they were planted together. When the Europeans came and began to colonize New England, they thought it was a mess. They thought, what is going on here, right? We monocrop things. Everything needs order. It needs its place, right? But not in indigenous farming practices. A great book on this called Changes in the Land, a guy named William Cronin wrote, that's about the Puritan encounter with Native American planting. So it's not simply the case that all human cultures are anthropocentric, but by and large, we acknowledge that they are. So as I said, for my purposes, I'm going to proceed assuming that there's an ecological crisis that is the case. I think that this quote here helpfully acknowledges the limited scope of our imaginations, right? There's only so much a human can imagine, right, in terms of its experience of the world.
What is the cartoon?
Oh, I thought that was kind of cool. So I was looking at medieval manuscripts of animals that when they were like translating the, copying manuscripts, they would get bored and they would draw these little doodles in the margins of medieval manuscripts. And I thought it was really interesting. I mean, here are animals having like a jousting session and they're riding on the human that's like a snail. Like, how creative is that? I was like, well, that's kind of anthropocentric. At least they're anthropomorphizing the animals. That's kind of interesting. So yeah, it's just kind of a tongue-in-cheek pun on anthropocentrism. I'm glad you asked about it. There's a lot of examples of these. Okay, let me tell you a quick story about how anthropocentrism kind of works. So there's a book called Fossil Capital by a historian named Andreas Malm. And this is a really interesting story that he tells about how sort of deep our anthropocentric attitudes go to the level of like hyper-individualism, right? That it's not even through other people that I experience the world, or it's really from my own sort of vantage point. So in this book called Fossil Capital, Andreas Malm tells a story about 1770s Scotland, Clyde, Scotland. And the story is about an engineer named Robert Tom. And he's working in Clyde. He's a freshly, I think he went to Glasgow or something like that, new engineer, and his work is in hydropower. And so the problem that Tom encountered was that you had all these little cotton mills on the around Clyde, Scotland, and they were not doing too well, right? They were failing businesses. And to make a, it's a really interesting story. He realized that if they could just take some of the rivers, reroute them, right, that you could set up multiple shops along the river that you could to receive the hydropower. And he experimented with this and was successful on a really small scale. So he realized, he was, okay, we can get away from coal. This is in like this is between the 1770s and the 1820s. Get away from coal, right? And we'll reroute the rivers, we'll terraform the stuff, right? And the water will free flow. It was called the free energy, is what they called it. He was successful, moderately successful, but ultimately he failed. And let me just, he failed at the level of working with the business owners about moving the water to where they could share it. So cotton mill up here, cotton mill down here, right? They were had all this kind of like lock system that would unleash the water. Do y'all have any guesses of why he failed at the level of business? Like what the problem was that he couldn't overcome working with individual business owners? They could not figure out how to share the water. They were like, we can't, they couldn't work together. I mean, it was it was elegant. He had these beautiful maps. He showed how it could work. But when he actually sat down with business owners, town council people, all of this, they couldn't work together, right? They couldn't share this free resource. So what did they revert to? And this is where we are. This is why it's called fossil capital. Any clue, what energy source do you think the Scottish business owners, they're like, we don't want to deal with the water because we don't want to deal with each other. What do you think they went to power the plants? Coal. Yeah, it was coal, which is dirty, extractive, and expensive. Tom showed, he demonstrated, he had these elaborate presentations. He showed it's cheap, right, just to reroute the water. If we can all pool it in together, right, we'll do this public works project, release the water. And they said, we would rather burn extractive, expensive, dirty coal in our. There was a moment, and hydropower comes with its own ecological consequences, no doubt. But there was this little moment in 1820s Scotland where we, right, insofar as it impacted the United States as well, we almost went hydropower and not coal power, right? It almost happened. And it was because these business owners in Clyde, Scotland could not figure out how to work together. And the story that Mom tells in Fossil Capital and that like he documents, I mean, it got rancorous. It went all the way to, you know, high level politics. And these guys were screaming at each other, right? This business owner, well, you're going to have the water before me, and how do I guarantee that you're not going to hoard it upriver? You know, I mean, it was crazy. So we end up with extractive, expensive, dirty fuel source. What's so interesting to me about this story in Fossil Capital is how it illustrates this anthropocentric point, right? That it's me and mine, my business, right? Not connected to others. I'm not willing to give anything to my neighbor, right? Because I need to commodify it. Right. So here we are, extractive, expensive, dirty fuel. Yeah.
About that same time, they were moving to this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the 1700s, they got out of Scotland and came to the U.S.
Wilmington, North Carolina.
And North Carolina. Yep. And Pennsylvania was part of it all too.
That's right. Yeah, I've now lived in two of the like strongest Presbyterian, Scots Presbyterian strongholds, Cape Fear River Valley and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So yeah, the Scots come over and they find a point and they stop and they set their stuff up. So yeah. This had a profound influence on how the United States did business. I mean, imagine a waterworks right off the Allegheny or the Mon, right, where the businesses were powered by hydropower rather than coal. I don't know if that would be possible in the U.S., but this is rich history. It almost happened. So we can go to the next slide. So where does anthropocentrism emerge in the Bible? I'm not going to read both of these, but on the left-hand side, I've given you a snippet of Genesis chapter 1, right? And on the other side, Genesis chapter 2. I'll just ask, it's okay if no one wants to speak up or whatever, but do y'all know offhand which of Genesis 1 or Genesis 2, which one has humanity as the crown of creation that dominion is given to? Do y'all know which one are the dominion of humanity comes from? It's Genesis 1. So Genesis 1 is the story of humanity crowning creation, right? This very ordered account on the first day, on the second day, on the third day, right? And then humanity is formed by the word of God, right? And said in creation, said, this is all yours, right? You have dominion over it. We could talk about this a lot more, but to oversimplify, it is out of Genesis chapter 1 that we get an anthropocentric dominion strand in, we can say, Jewish theology and Christian theology, right? This is one strand. Genesis 2 is a second creation story. It's quite different. Do y'all know what happens in Genesis 2, how the human is created? It's out of the dust of the earth, right? Not by a word, right? But out of the dust. Genesis 2 gives us a very different picture, I think, of humanity's relationship to all of creation, one that is not anthropocentric, right? So Genesis 1, none of that language of dust and all of that is there. Genesis 2, it is. So I'll just read here from Genesis 2 because I like this. In that day that the Lord God made the heavens and the earth, when no plant of the field was yet in the earth and no vegetation of the field had yet sprung up, for the Lord God had not caused it to rain, et cetera, et cetera. Then the Lord God formed man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And the man became a living being. And the Lord planted a garden in Eden in the east, and there he put the man whom he had formed out of the ground. You see this refrain, out of the ground, right? The human was taken out of the ground, not spoken into existence, but out of the ground. The Lord also made all the trees grow. They were pleasant and they were good for food, et cetera, et cetera. Then the Lord took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to till it and to keep it, right? We could get into some of the semantic discussions about dominion in Genesis 1 and tilling and keeping in Genesis 2. But I think these are significant differences, right? That the command is not to have dominion over it, like in Genesis 1. It's to till it and to keep it, to take care of it, right? You may freely eat of every tree of the garden, but if you eat of the other one, right, you'll surely die. So what I want to point out here is just really two basic streams. One is that there's a live and active anthropocentrism in the books of Moses, right, in Genesis 1. But there's also this other possibility, right, that is one where humanity is more deeply in rhythm, right, as a caregiver, right, alongside others. And the logic here is the human is a caregiver alongside others, right, because the human is taken from the same ground that everything else is taken from, right? Okay, go to the next slide. Where else does this show up? So I want to kind of, I could look at a bunch of different passages from the Hebrew Bible, but I love these verses from Ecclesiastes and from the Psalms. There's this sort of, this possibility of humans being like other creatures, right, that we could develop. So Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verses 18 to 20. I said in my heart with regard to human beings that God is testing them to show that they are but animals. For the fate of humans and the fate of animals is the same. as one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath. This is really beautiful stuff. And humans have no advantage over the animals. That's a very different perspective than Genesis chapter 1, right? So there's this argument going on in the Hebrew Bible. They all have the same breath, and humans have no advantage over the animals, for all is vanity. All go to one place, all are from the dust, and all turn to dust again, right? Origin is the same, the end is the same, right? There's this deep commonality. Something a bit more uplifting that's not just all is vanity comes from Psalm 104, verses 24 to 30. This is the psalmist extolling God's creative wisdom. Oh Lord, how manifold are your works. In wisdom you have made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. There is the sea, gentle and wide. Creeping things innumerable are there. Living things, both small and great. There go the ships and the Leviathan, the great sea beast that you formed to sport in it. These all look to you to give them their food in due season. So you've got this emphasis on rhythm, right? Seasonal rhythms here. It's all from the gracious hand of God. When you give to them, they gather it up. When you open your hand, they are filled with good things. When you hide your face, they are dismayed. When you take away their breath, they die and they return to their dust, right? When you send forth your spirit, they are created, and you renew the face of the ground. So this is really a clarification of the one of those statements that I made earlier, right? That number one, God is a gracious and good creator, sovereign over all life, reflected in Psalm 104. It is through our relationship with all other life that God creates and sustains. The breath is the same. We're taken from the same dust. Therefore, human life is interconnected with and dependent on all life on earth. I think this is not modern theology, right? This is the theology of the Psalms. I think we got a question up here.
The creation part of this whole story is God.
Right.
And then there's the people who are dealing with what was given to them or what is around them.
Mm-hmm.
And they figured out how to make things work for them.
Right.
The coal was there, but they dug it out and stayed warm in the wintertime.
Right.
There's two things going on here. There's creation and there's figuring it out.
That's right.
And I'm still figuring it out in my quarter acre that I have. I'm trying to figure out, what am I going to do with all those leaves?
Right. Yeah, I mean, creation is use, right? What's the use value of creation? I mean, that's one question, right? The humans of how do we create technologies, right, that help us better harness what's there for our use. I think that there's another perspective too, that what happens when we simply let it be what it is. But yeah, did you have a follow up to? Yeah, the figuring it out. Yeah.
I'm interested in the sort of parallels between humans and animals and the way they're described as almost being the same.
Right.
But can we think about intelligence here? Because is that, animals, I love them, but they aren't able to figure out things the way humans are. So then that puts us in a different position.
That's right.
But it also makes us more responsible, which we're really good at what is to our advantage. We're not so good at doing things in a responsible way.
Yeah.
So that's just a dilemma.
No, I think that's an excellent point. Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly it. The history of philosophy is one of trying to figure out what makes us distinct and unique. And one of the things that always comes up is rationality, right? The humans are a rational animal. Some people have called us But on the other hand, too, animals have vast intelligences that we don't understand, right? There's this great little essay called How to Think Like a Bat Through Echolocation. So we can't do it. The bat must have an amazing understanding of the world through echolocation that we can't even begin to comprehend, right? Yeah.
And orcas seem to have an understanding of these boats that are coming into their environment and are doing things that we don't fully understand, going after those boats and getting them.
That's right, like trying to tear them up. Yeah, I saw a video the other day of, you know, deep diving submarines, right? And they were really close to a whale carcass, and the shark started to attack the submarine because they thought it was a threat to the food. So, I mean, and the way they were circling up, it was beautiful and fascinating. Yeah, I mean, there's a... So I think that... I think we're maybe, I mean, you make a good point, right? Humans are distinct, right? And as the quote I read says, we have a remarkable ability to manipulate the earth, right? No other creature can do that, to my knowledge, not at that scale, and not with that kind of intentionality. But I think on the other hand, we have to acknowledge, and I think we haven't done a great job of this as a species, there's vast intelligences, right, that we can't even begin to understand. So like the cartoon, right, we have to make the animal as close to us as possible to understand it, because we only understand it from our vantage point. And I think really what I'm after here is just a call to a kind of basic humility, right, that we need to be humble in the face of the diversity that we're confronted with on the planet. And that we may need to begin to acknowledge that animals, other creatures, right, have capacities that far outpace our capacities in some cases. So, yeah, but I mean, that's a really great point. Other questions or thoughts or comments?
Hey, I'll have to think about this throughout the week, but, you know, do we misuse our intellect?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's so the answer I would, we can talk about this more next week when we look at what Christ's ministry teaches. I think absolutely. And this is where I was talking about use value. Like when I look, when I go up to Garfield Farm, right, this summer, I look at that land with a kind of intentionality where now they're doing really great stuff there. But I think, how am I going to use this space? I used it for teaching. The summer, I use it to get food, right? I use it to build community. And rarely do I ask myself the question, what would happen if I just kind of let it be what it is? That was the debate on the Chattooga River. Let the river be simply what it is, because there's something more going on here, right, than a use value, a place to go fishing, a place to go kayaking, a place, whatever, that serves as a clean water source or whatever. Right, but we tend to think in terms of use, right? Because we apply our rationality to it and say, what can I extract, right? What can I get out of this? So I think that is that's the dilemma of anthropocentrism, is how do we get ourselves beyond that? Yeah, Ted.
Maybe this is exactly what you were talking about, but when you talk about us misusing our intellect, isn't that the point of that story in Genesis in the Garden of Eden?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's right. Rather than care, well, I haven't thought about that before, right? That the sin there is that, hey, this is all for you to enjoy, right? And then this invitation to use it, right, for one's own, in which, in the way the story's told, is to gain knowledge and insight. That's interesting. I haven't thought about that. That's really good. Yeah, the sin is not necessarily disobeying God, but not being okay with where you are and what you've been given. Yeah, that's great. Other questions or points? Yeah.
We live a couple miles down this way.
Mm-hmm.
And we had no animals living at our house. And the neighbors had a bunch of cats, and then they brought three Rottweilers.
Oh, gosh.
And all of a sudden, the cat came over to our house.
Mm-hmm.
Now the cat sleeps on our sofa in the living room.
That's awesome.
And he's got one of the pillows is his.
Right.
I'm wondering, are we the parents of the cat, or is he the magician that makes us do what he wants?
I mean, as a cat person, I think it's the latter. I think you've been tricked into caregiving for it. Yeah, that's the king of the house. That's great. Y'all usually wrap up around 10:45. Is that
yeah.
Okay? We've just got. Let me do the last slide here. This is some. Just bear with me with this. This is going to kind of set up our conversation for next week. So, okay, this is a much better slide. You can actually read it. Okay. So here's what Doug Ottati has to say about humans. I think this is really, there's a lot here, and I'll unpack this a little bit more next week. And I'm going to raise a few questions based on this. But here's what Ottati says. In the context of the divine governance, God's sovereignty over all life, the world beyond humans has value. I think that's, we all agree on that. Whether we live that way or not, it's another question, but we agree on that. The world beyond our species has value, and human beings have worth, not as the lone central or primary point of God's world, but as worthy participants with distinctive qualities and capabilities to whom God stands related as creator, judge, and redeemer. I think this goes to your point and to the point you just made about the use of the intellect, right, and the use of rationality. How can we misuse it to not be good participants in the world that God has given us, right? That's where the judgment comes in. And I would argue that what we're experiencing, mass climate migration that's about to occur, disease in certain communities because of environmental degradation, is God's judgment, right? Sadly, the people who are least responsible often are judged the harshest. Think about like Cancer Alley outside of New Orleans, places like this, right? Poor, impoverished communities who were the ones being judged. But I could say more about that. The worth of humans in the context of the divine dynamic is not something that we, whether as individuals, communities, or institutions, either construct or bestow. And this helps answer the question of what we are here for by promoting a theistic, that is God-centered, sensibility that emphasizes the dynamic interrelationships of God, world, and ourselves. This Christian theocentric piety, and what he means here, is just a way of living, right? A way of living in response to God. That's a theocentric piety. Displaces, that is, we're no longer the center of things, but also repositions human beings. It criticizes our inveterate tendency to picture ourselves as the primary point of all reality, but it also recognizes our inalienable worth as distinctive participants in God's world. So we're going to work on this a little bit more. What does Christ teach us about a deeply theocentric piety, where we're not the point, right? Something else is God's the point, right? So here's some questions to think about. How does Ottati's perspective on God move us beyond anthropocentrism, right? A human-centered focus. That's what this is all about, is repositioning us, no longer anthropocentrism, but theocentrism. Number two, how might Ottati's perspective help us rethink our relationship with the world and other creatures? Cat setting up shop and a home, right? How are we being displaced and reoriented in that relationship? And then number three, what practices and actions might this decentering perspective help generate? And here we're talking about the level of public policy, I believe. That's the only way to really put a root into some of this. But how do we move from thinking about it to action? And the action can be very local, like Garfield Community Farm, right? Permaculture practices on a quarter acre of land. We're no longer mowing our lawns, right? We're using them as places for biodiversity to take root, right? No longer monoculture, et cetera. But how does this quote here set up a program for thinking about practice and action. And we'll talk, and that's where I'm going to try to answer some of the questions next week with reflecting on Jesus Christ's incarnation and ministry. So we've got we're over time. It's 10:46, but thanks for listening. I hope it was coherent.
Thank you.